You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was the verbal tug of war that thrust the term alternative facts into the nation's vocabulary. NBC's Chuck Todd sparring with White House counselor Kellyanne Conway over the administration's insistence on inflating the crowd size at the president's inauguration.
Excuse me, it does not excuse,
and you did not answer the question.
You did not answer
the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
on
day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Yes, what a moment. But pushing out alternative facts isn't new, and it's not just in the arenas of politics and the media. It's been happening in the scientific arena for decades. And that's something Kevin Elliott wants to warn us about as we all read about the latest new scientific breakthrough or research. Kevin is an associate professor of philosophy at Michigan State University in the Lyman Briggs College and the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. And with us now, Kevin, let's start with that very term, alternative facts. What does that phrase mean to you?
Yeah, well, as I think we can gather from that clip, it's sort of a euphemism for basically a falsehood. The suggestion is trying to spin something that's really not true and give it this label of alternative facts. And so I thought it was really interesting and an opportunity to extend this topic from the political context and think about how this has happened in the sciences as well.
And you've done an analysis of case studies of alternative facts in science. What were you looking at? Before we talk about the examples, what were you actually looking at?
My interest in this came from, and I'm, of course, not the first person to do this. There's a lot of really interesting work that historians of science and philosophers of science have been doing, looking at basically this kind of phenomenon historically. And part of the motivation was our current situation with climate change, trying to understand why there was so much conflict or confusion about the phenomenon. And so they sort of looked back historically and have provided some context for the confusion that we have now. And that's sort of how I got interested in this.
So give us some of the prominent examples of alternative facts pushed out to the public in the arena of science.
Probably the classic example that people often go back to that's perhaps the most striking is that of the tobacco industry that a lot of us are familiar with, where back in the 1950s, when it was becoming pretty clear that there was strong evidence that smoking caused lung cancer, and the tobacco companies were really worried about this and met with a prominent public relations firm and developed a whole set of strategies for trying to convince the public that there wasn't actually so much of a problem. And in some of their internal documents, they actually have this line that doubt is our product. They didn't have to convince the public that it was definitely safe, but if they could just raise doubts, that this could be tremendously helpful for them. And so they provided kind of a model that then other industries have used since then. The chemical industry in Michigan, we're all familiar with the Flint situation. The lead industry used a number of these same strategies. And there's a wonderful book by a couple historians of science called Merchants of Doubt. And they've actually traced some of these same public relations firms and scientists and strategies through tobacco and then casting doubt on acid rain and then the ozone hole and now climate change. So it's a really fascinating historical story.
And even as we're talking, a very recent development was about Roundup, the Monsanto, one of its biggest product, the weed killer. And a judge has ordered documents to be unsealed, and they really raise questions about the safety of Roundup and the research practices that Monsanto has used in it.
Yeah, that's another excellent example where actually, one of the lessons that I would want to draw about this is the importance of fostering more transparency in science, more openness to data and methods and deliberations. And I think that applies both in the industry sector, where there are concerns, these same kinds of concerns in the pharmaceutical industry, where we may not be getting access to all the data that they have, that they may be somewhat selective in what they publish and make known. And like you pointed out, in the Roundup situation, I don't know all the details there, but it illustrates these worries that we may not be privy to all the information that we would really like to have out there and available to the public.
And even in terms of perhaps not as nefarious an attempt as we saw, for example, as you cited in the tobacco industry, where all of that internal stuff was certainly augmented with ads, because we can all remember those ads from the 40s and 50s showing doctors, sketches of doctors in white coats smoking cigarettes and recommending. So they worked closely with their advertisers. But also when we think of the media, of reporters reporting on scientific studies, and everything sounds like the biggest new breakthrough. And it, we as the consuming public have to take that with a big grain of salt, don't we?
Yeah. And actually, I really like your point that it's not all nefarious, because you have certain cases that are just really striking, where you had, for example, the tobacco industry just flat out lying. But then you have much more subtle things. And, you know, I gave a talk about this recently at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And this was in a day-long seminar where they were discussing concerns in academic science, where you may not have such striking financial conflicts of interest, but you still have pressures because of the desire to publish, to get attention for work, to get further grant funding, that there's just incentives to put out the latest finding. And, you know, when you get negative findings that aren't so striking, there's not that pressure to publish, and it may even be difficult to publish. And so there are just these natural incentives that, you know, we find out about certain information and don't about others. And so this is really important, as you point out, for us as the public, that, you know, if we see some new study that just came out, we don't want to overly emphasize that. We really want to get a sense of what's the overall sense of the scientific community and what's the overall set of information in multiple studies. So that's a great point.
That's the challenge for those of us who are reporters, to get that context and not just jump with whatever press release the university or the science center puts out.
And I think that, you know, it is exciting that I think the media has started to become more sophisticated. A classic example, again, is climate change, where there was a very definite strategy on the part of some of the industry to, when you had climatologists come out and talk about climate change, for them to find somebody to try to give an opposing perspective. And initially, I think the media, because of their effort to be balanced, fell into this trap of just presenting both sides. And I think the media has become more savvy, realizing if 97% of the peer-reviewed papers are emphasizing that, you know, human actions and greenhouse gases are contributing to climate change, and there's just this tiny little minority, often who aren't climate scientists, who are questioning this, well, then it's actually not balanced to give both sides equal attention. And so I'm excited to see the media starting to become more sophisticated and careful about that.
Kevin, is there a risk that even as by having this conversation, we undermine trust in sound science?
You know, I think there's always the potential, but I think that we all really want to develop a public that's more sophisticated in terms of their perspectives on science. And I think we all recognize that, you know, that science is a gradual process, that it builds up, that, you know, we can't just trust single studies. And so I think it's overall a good thing for the public to recognize that science is a complicated process and that they shouldn't just accept the latest idea. But it's also really important to remember the value of organizations like the National Academy of Sciences that comes out with really solid reports that give a good sense of the overall state of opinion. And so if I were offering advice to the public, I would say, really give weight to the kinds of reports coming out of these established, respected scientific organizations. And we don't want to just sort of dismiss the scientific community as a whole. We just want to be thoughtful in our responses to science.
And to that point, more advice. I want you to give more advice to consumers, to the people who are reading, maybe finding some hope in some of these reports, sharing them on Facebook or tweeting them out. What are the litmus tests we should apply as we, the public, read about the new scientific research so we can sort out the alternative facts from sound science?
Yeah, and I want to acknowledge that this isn't always easy for the public, mm-hmm. and that's where I do think that the media can play a really valuable role in sort of helping to give a sense of sort of key reports and, you know, the perspectives of the scientific community as a whole. Of course, there are certain, you know, basic things the public can do. Obviously, it's always more important to appeal to peer-reviewed publications than those that aren't. There are journals that are really well-respected, like Science and Nature and, you know, the Journal of the American Medical Association and so on. But as we were talking earlier, you know, any individual publication, you know, we don't want to put too much weight in. So like I mentioned, these, you know, organizations like in the UK, the Royal Society, or in the US, the National Academy of Sciences, getting a sense of the scientific community as a whole. And I would also say to just, I think the public can educate themselves, you know, through, you know, books like Merchants of Doubt and so on, to realize there are these efforts to confuse the public and to create, you know, think tanks and, you know, front groups that sound good, that have good names, but that are actually, you know, trying to present this sort of skewed message. And I acknowledge it's not always easy. And this is where we need the media to really help us filter this information.
Guarding ourselves against alternative facts in science. Calvin Elliott is an associate professor of philosophy at Michigan State University. His book is A Tapestry of Values, An Introduction to Values in Science. It was great talking with you, Kevin, with great advice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.